a lonely prison wall, I heard a young girl calling, Michael, they have taken you away, for you stole Trevelyan's corn. So the young might see the morn. Now a prison ship lies waiting in the bay.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
We hope you like us when we're angry. I'm Dean Carianis.
I'm Owen Mugen.
And welcome back to the Angry History Podcast. We have a very special guest with us today. Owen, why don't you go ahead and introduce our buddy to the listeners?
I'm just going to need a second coming out of that song. Hold on.
Harbor wall, she watched the last star falling as the prison ship sailed out against the sky. For she lived in hope and pray for her love in Botany Bay. It's so lonely around the fields of Appenrine.
All right. Yes, we have with us today Letham Burns. Letham, welcome to Angry History, pal.
G'day, guys. I've been a long-time listener, and I'm just honored to be invited on your show. Thank you so much.
The honor is ours. As you can hear, Letham is from Australia, specifically Western Australia, and he's here today to talk about the other coast of the land down under, Sydney's Botany Bay.
Botany Bay. That was the name of a penal colony on the shores of Australia, wasn't it? They took that name for their vessel.
If you're suggesting this was a penal deportation vessel, you've arrived at a totally illogical conclusion.
Botany Bay. Botany Bay. Oh, no. We've got to get out of here now.
From a real Wrath of Khan movie.
And by the way, that is the only time Chekhov was any good.
And he wasn't even in Space Seed.
I know, exactly. The 30 seconds of time that Chekhov justified his existence.
And this is awesome. No matter what topic we've got, Star Trek is always, you know, relevant and prevalent. I love it. This
oh,
is
sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it runs through us, under us, beneath us, around us. You know, it is the transwarp blood that pumps our hearts.
Yep.
Well, listen, on January 20th, 1788, what is celebrated as Australia Day in our time, the first fleet arrived in what would later be Sydney. The voyage from England had taken 252 days. That's 8.5 months at sea, and this was not a luxury trip by any stretch. Among those on board were 775 prisoners, men and women, exiled to the far side of the earth. Now, Letham, what's the source of your anger about the role these people played in founding your country? These were not hardened criminals, unlike yourself, we're talking
about. That's right. Unlike myself, these weren't necessarily hardened criminals. I mean, we're talking about, some of the sources of my anger about this were the petty nature of the transportable offences here and the really young ages of some of these transportees, the horrifying conditions that they suffered both on board the ships and once they actually got to the colonies here, the penal colonies, and also the really institutionalised and barbaric mistreatment of these convicts by the government officials, once they got there. It was just horrendous all round.
And I have to say one thing about the trip. Somehow in my mind, I guess, I always pictured it as if you wanted a long voyage like that, after a few days or so, you'd get over the seasickness. But when I was reading about this, they said the hardest part of the trip was the journey across the Irish Sea, often for people who came from Ireland or from Scotland, like your ancestors. But they said you would be seasick the whole time and laying on the deck and the wetting, they called it, because there's no shelter. And I just thought, I cannot imagine. I mean, I've been nauseous on New Year's Eve. I've been, waking up. I can't imagine being that nauseous until Labor Day weekend, which is the length of this trip.
Dean can't even watch The Love Boat. It's awful.
No, I can't. And I really like Vicky, too, but I just – wait, that sounds creepier now because I'm old.
Exciting and new, come aboard, we're expecting you.
Well, But when I was a kid, that wasn't creepy.
And Dean, I've had the privilege of spending some time with you on ships, both on Barrier Reef and off the Jersey Shore. And I think we've both experienced the horrors of short-term seasickness. So, yeah, absolutely.
That's right. Lotham and I snorkeled on the Great Barrier Reef, and unfortunately, I hit my head, and I wasn't feeling too good after that. So I just cannot imagine.
When were you there, guys?
2005.
2005.
In May, yeah.
Yeah, that was great.
I was there in 1980 for about a month. So yeah, so we were all there. Well, I'm obviously left.
Yeah,
that's great. That at least we all have a frame of reference. We have gone there. As a matter of fact, we flew Air New Zealand down, and we stopped in Auckland for about 45 minutes on the way down. But when we did cross the equator, I still have from Air New Zealand my Captain Cook, hey little boy, you crossed the equator too certificate, which I still have.
That's awesome. Nice.
I don't think they got that on the first fleet though.
No, they didn't. They got rickets.
Yeah, and thanks for taking all that time to head down there, because I know it's a long trip to get down there. So thanks very much for heading to the Southern Hemisphere. Greatly appreciated.
And I may make some enemies on this, but I'm all Hawthorne all the way. It's a local football club. They gave me a shirt when I was 10, made me wear it.
Oh, mate, I can't comment on that. I'll have to be quiet on that one. Sorry, mate. Sorry.
I figured. Lethem, what were some of the crimes that would earn you this terrible ticket?
Yeah, sure, and that's a really good question, because they really were petty crimes, because the crimes that were more violent in nature tended to be punished directly by execution. So we're talking about people who were more doing crimes against material and property rather than acts of aggression. So we're talking about things like prostitution, thefts under the value of one shilling, receiving stolen goods, stealing lead. I mean, you can hear that there's some pretty ridiculous...
One shilling.
Yeah. I mean, pretty petty and some pretty really ridiculous sort of crimes here. I mean, stealing fish from a pond or a river, stealing roots, trees, or plants. An interesting one is assaulting, cutting, or burning clothes. Now, I mean, I don't know why that would be such a big crime, but it would earn you a one-way trip to Australia back then. Things like counterfeiting, stealing a shroud from a grave for some reason was prevalent enough to warrant specific reference to get you exported out to Australia. So not hugely violent crimes, just more petty crimes.
Why is such a low threshold? You understand if people if society is being upended, but I mean, it's almost like this is like, Victor Hugo stuff we're talking about.
Yeah. And I think, and that's a really good question. I think it's, at the time they really had to set, impress upon people the consequence, the dire consequence of some of these crimes. I mean, and some of these crimes against property were originally resulting in execution. And some of the instances that we might talk about later on are instances where, just young kids convicted of petty theft, petty larceny, and they're sentenced to execution. But they managed to, say, get a stay of execution and instead get sent out to Australia. So, yeah, really low threshold was set.
We have a clip, actually, and I wanted to ask you, I didn't get a chance, if you had heard of this movie or seen it, 1988's Bound for Botany Bay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I feel like any movie made in 1988 in Australia must have been pretty awesome. But this is a reenactment of the judge in London passing death sentences for these really petty crimes. And he reads them all out, and you hear people, the reenactment, of course, they're gasping. But I'm sure that they really were reacting that way at the time, because it's so shocking. So here we go from Bound for Botany Bay.
Joseph Thomas, indicted at the Old Bailey, October 1782, for feloniously assaulting Mary Cullen on the King's Highway, putting her in fear, and taking from her person and against her will one silk handkerchief value 2 shillings. Guilty, sentenced to death. Broad, Mary, no occupation, indicted for feloniously assaulting Agnes Lakeman, spinster. Found guilty of highway robbery, sentenced to be hanged. Hilt, William, indicted for feloniously breaking and entering the dwelling house of Agnes Roberts' widow, about 3 in the afternoon, no person being therein, and stealing thereout 1 silk purse, value 6 pence, and 9 guineas, value £9.09. Guilty, housebreaking, to be hanged.
And even when they say they're felonious assault, it's basically, ran up to this woman and grabbed a handkerchief. It's not like he even knocked her to the ground. A lot of these crimes, you can just hear the actor really did a good job, just the arbitrariness of it and the dispassionate, well, you're all going to be hung. And then they come and say, well, no, actually, good news is you're just going to be sent on a horrible, death-defying journey. And even what got me, too, was even the people who were on the boat, the seamen that were sent along, they were not looking forward to this either. One of the Marines wrote, "Oh my God, all my hopes are over of ever seeing my beloved wife and son." I mean, they just figured that was it. You know, you could never, there's no email, there's no phone, there's no anything. You're just being sent God knows where.
Yeah, I mean, as a comparison, when I left Australia to move to the other side of the world, you know, came over here to America, my biggest concern then was that, oh no, I'm paying 3 cents a minute for an international phone call on my phone card instead of 2 cents a minute. I mean, that was my biggest issue. I mean, these guys were never necessarily going back. It was a one way trip for most of these people.
You heard that in the song in the beginning, and that's why Owen finds it so moving.
Yeah.
Okay, your husband is convicted, and he was stealing food for the family. And, you know, obviously that's not all the stories, but there are some of those that could land you a trip down.
Right.
You got to be stuck here and raise our kids with dignity and all that. Oh, my gosh, it breaks your heart to think of it.
And how are you expected to raise your child in dignity when the government under which they live is so oppressive and it's like there's zero compassion? What do you do? It's a horrifying reality.
Yeah. And America, actually, our revolution played a role in this, didn't it, Latham?
Yeah. I mean, I got to say, thanks so much for you guys. I mean, when you beat the British back in that revolution thing that you had back then, and all of a sudden the British could no longer send their convicts over to North America, so they had to look for other shores, and they decided on Australia, which was very fortunate for us because it was one of our founding cornerstones of our nation.
Wow. Yeah.
It's amazing too, though, the people that they would send. This, you gave us some names. This Dorothy Handlin, 82, just a rag woman. Another woman, Elizabeth Beckford, 70 years old, who stole 12 pounds of Gloucester cheese, which I guess is understandable. You know, sense.
Well, it is cheese. It's pretty good cheese.
64 slices of American cheese.
Yeah.
There's that. So. Yeah.
But now this one I can understand. 22-year-old Elizabeth Powley stole a few shillings worth of bacon. So
bacon.
Yeah.
and she was sentenced to death for this initially?
Yeah, the Grand Theft Bacon.
Yeah.
Ay.
There was the 9-year-old chimney sweep, John Hudson, who was condemned to 7 years exile for theft.
Nothing wrong with there being a 9-year-old chimney sweep, though, of course. Yeah. But, I mean, we're talking about an insanely harsh penal system.
He said penal. Yeah.
Penal.
Oppression.
There was a big crime wave, too, though, that resulted in these harsh sentences, and they didn't have a lot of people to put people in the prisons, did they?
Yeah, and we've got to consider when this was. This is around the late 18th century, and you know, Britain really saw an upswing in crime, probably from, you know, one factor of the poverty that happened from here was the Industrial Revolution. A lot of people were migrating from the country to the cities for work. Oftentimes, this work wasn't there. Vast overcrowding, no social services whatsoever. And so crimes of, for survival often prevailed at this point. And the British prisons were really beyond capacity because, as we mentioned, you know, North America was no longer being available for transportation destination. And so they were looking for other solutions. And so Australia was seen as a solution for, you know, a solution to many problems that they had at that point.
It's a shame that it took until 1996 to start shooting our convicts into space.
A group of criminals could have been dealt with far more efficiently than wasting one of their most advanced spaceships.
Botany Bay. Botany Bay. Oh, no.
That's right, 2 Chekhov bites.
Awesome.
Okay, now, Latham, you are descended yourself from a couple of pretty shady hardcore criminals, so why don't we take a break, and I hope you'll want to talk about that when we come back. I know it's a painful subject for you. So let's just take a break, and we will come back.
We're happy little Vegemites as bright as I can be. We all enjoy our Vegemite for breakfast, lunch, and tea. Our mummy say we're growing stronger every single week because we love our Vegemite. We all adore our Vegemite. It puts a rose in every cheek.
Jim Vegemite. The delicious spread provides the vitamin B1 your family needs daily. Be sure you put Vegemite next to the pepper and salt whenever you set the table.
Thank you for the horrible flashback to being asked to try Vegemite for the first time at age 10. I was trying to be a good guest, as my Nana and godmother were trying to impress upon me. But you know what? I just couldn't do it. Couldn't take it.
Well, thanks so much for at least trying, because it's a big ask, because you know I was brought up on it, so I love it. To me, it's heaven in a jar. But I know for anybody else who wasn't brought up in Australia, it's kind of like the equivalent of congealed soy sauce. So I got to say, thanks so much for trying it.
Oh, not at all. But you come from tough prison stock, so you know you're able to handle it. So explain more about these criminals that fall out of your tree.
It's a pretty dark and seedy sort of tale here, and we're very hesitant to talk about the skeletons that are in our closet here on this one. A lot of this information comes from two sources. My auntie has actually been doing a bit of family history research, so she came up with some information. And Dean, your wife Kathy did some remarkable detective work, and she really is she's a modern day Nancy Drew. I mean, she was able to go back in time, and I'm honest, find stuff that not even our family knew about, and she found newspaper clippings about this. So you know, she's incredible. She did an amazing job.
A lot of that's from Ancestry.com, and there's we're going to hear a clip later actually from Brad Argent from Ancestry.com.au, the Australian branch of Ancestry, and you can find a lot of stuff there, a lot of stuff in the Scottish and Irish archives. So that was really great. And also we found some pictures for you, which I don't know if she sent you yet, but those are really fun too, to look back and see some pictures.
Oh, just amazing. Absolutely incredible. So what a great resource. So thank you very much for that. So my family going over to Australia. On my father's side, my great-great-grandparents, John Thomas Burns and his wife Agnes.
Awesome name. John Thomas.
You can't go wrong with that name, mate. I mean, that's going to get you a long way through life. So they immigrated with their children from Melrose in Scotland. They moved over to Australia in 1852. So just imagine going over on a sailing ship, you know, for all those months, not just yourself, but with your young family for months and months back in 1852. So they came over. They weren't convicts, but, you know, down the track, things happen. And the closest we've got to convicts in our family is my great uncle, Robert David Burns. He was a tailor working in Perth and during the 1940s, and he and his brother-in-law were convicted of overcharging customers for double-breasted two-piece suits.
That monster!
I know!
Wait, you've got to tell everyone the brother-in-law's name.
Oh, William Faulkner. This is great. The nerve of these people. I mean, I didn't even know you could overcharge for suits. I mean, I thought it was a free economy. I mean, in my mind, you know, if people are willing to pay for it, it's a fair price. So,
and who's really, and you know, double-breasted suits, really, who's going to wear one? The 40s.
That's true, it was the 40s. Well, but, and you know, especially when you consider Latham, is that why you have an aversion to this day to double breasts and pants?
That's right. I never wear pants. I mean, that's why I don't wear pants at all. It's the association.
No.
So, yes.
Very painful for the family.
You're better off that way.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with pants? You're going to keep keys in your pocket. Next thing you know, you're opening doors you shouldn't open.
And that's how you get into trouble. Exactly.
Just ask Bluebird's wife.
Exactly. So now we're not talking about, you know, the Love Boat or any sort of ship that bears any resemblance to civilized sea travel of today. What were the conditions like when you're on this? I mean, and this is, keep in mind, slave ships have been coming across the ocean for 200 years at this point, or 400 years at this point. That was a bad scene. 1850s, things weren't much better.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely horrendous. So not only was there a horrendous shortage of water and fresh food, I mean, it would have been hardtack and stale water, you know, all the way, but not just those conditions, but it was just brutal. There was a lot of preying upon each other there as far as crimes amongst the convicts within the ships. I mean, there was a lot of taking advantage of each other, just, you know, manipulation and just, you know, it just would have been barbaric.
Well, I would imagine, you know, part of that has to be, you know, your government has told you that you're worth almost nothing. And instead of killing you, we're going to put you, criminal, with other criminals on this ship. Why would people be nice to each other? I mean, you may as well just give in to your base instincts at this point.
Absolutely.
It's Lord of the Flies.
Yes. Yeah. Yep, they'll all be dancing around a pig's head on a stake. Yeah, exactly. So that book, you know, always comes up. That was one of the books that we read in high school, and I got to thank them for making us read that awesome book. But it always comes up. It's brilliant. So
yeah.
I want to take a quick detour. And one book that I read in high school that always comes up is Neville Shoots on the Beach. That's a great Australian book. It's about Australia being the last continent unaffected by nuclear war until the winds blow their way down under. Anyway, pick it up. Great book. Decent movie with Fred Astaire.
Yeah, it is a great book. I think Tony Perkins is in that movie too.
He is.
And it kind of also gives you a sense of the isolation of Australia. And Right. You know, nowadays the world is very small, but you think of what it was like back then. I mean, even in the 1920s, Ireland, when I was on the tour there recently, they said we didn't really have much of an idea of where Europe was when we were kids in the 20s. So imagine you're going all the way to Australia and maybe you can't even read or write and you're an 8-year-old kid. I mean, or what have you. It's just amazing. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's play that Ancestry clip. Again, this is Brad Argent from Ancestry.com.au, and he's discussing what he sees as some of the myths of the convicts that he's come across in his research over the years. He's speaking at the National Museum of Australia in a longer discussion that we'll link at angryhistory.com, and you can really get a lot of information and point it in the right direction if you're looking to research your family tree in Australia. So here's Brad Argent.
Now, I've got to talk about convicts because they're so important. Important to... certainly the building of Australia in the very early days. They probably don't play as big a role as our free settlers or our assisted immigrants play in terms of building and expanding the nation. But these were the poor souls who, for whatever reason, were sent out here. And there's a couple of myths about convicts, and they're quite hotly debated. I think the vast bulk of them were just habitual criminals or opportunistic criminals, and they finally got caught and sent here. I think that whole myth about them, you know, having to steal to put bread on the table and being hard done by, I'm sure that happened on occasion, but the vast bulk of them certainly appear to be recidivist criminals who just finally got caught. And for some of them, they were caught more than once. They weren't violent criminals, and that's the big thing. I think only 2% of convicts were actually violent or convicted of violent crimes, because, of course, any violent crime, you got hung, because it was the period of the Bloody Code where, you know, you steal a handkerchief and you get sentenced to death, and it gets obviously converted to transportation for life. But we have an enormous amount of convict records on the site, and too many to go into. It is probably the most comprehensive set of Australian convict records you will find anywhere.
So that's an interesting, I thought, perspective, because all the other stuff that I read, and I trust they're researching, but it's interesting that there's such disagreement over how to cast the First Fleet and the convicts. So what do you think, Latham?
They might have just been petty criminals when they were first coming over, but I think as we mentioned, the circumstances they were put in would quickly turn them even further towards their base instinct, and I'm sure that would have escalated to a lot of murder and a lot of rape. And I think, you know, once the vestiges of civilization are removed from you, no matter how petty your crimes are, you're going to turn rather brutal. But they really were the cornerstone for the initial construction for a lot of our infrastructure and a lot of the historic buildings that we still have today. I mean, Australia's a pretty relatively young nation. Yeah, but the buildings that we have there, that anything over, say, 120, 130 years old, I mean, you're looking at likely that, there's a very good chance that convicts would have been involved in one way or another in their construction.
And in fact, when you think of coming to America, we know there's some stories of places people went. They obviously failed to settle here. They failed to find gold in South America. There was actually a big Scottish expedition down there to Costa Rica, I believe. One of Theodore Roosevelt's ancestors was in that dune mission. But in Australia, really, there's nothing there. I mean, it looks very green and lush, but it took 4 years just for the Botany Bay colony to be self-sustaining, for them to feed themselves. 4 years, 4 growing seasons, 4 planting seasons, 4 rain seasons. And they were getting their food shipped to them all the way around the world. It's insane to think of what they went through. And I think something that a person might miss, like what Brad Argent was talking about, is they may have been repeat criminals, but we can't conceive of the fact that there was an entire professional industry, you know, Thieves Guild, all this kind of stuff. Like, that was your job. If you were a kid and you had no family and there's no orphanage for you to go to, what do? You learn to pick pockets in gangs in New York, right? They go through the list of all the different criminal, basically, careers that people would have.
An angler put a hook on the end of a stick to drop behind store windows and doors. An autumn diver picked your pocket in church. A badger gets a fella into bed with a girl, then robs his pockets while they're on the go. Jenny was a bludgeon, a girl pickpocket, and a turtle dove. A turtle dove goes uptown dressed like a housemaid, picks out a fine house, and goes right through the back door. Robs you blind. takes a lot of sand to be a turtle dove.
That was your job. You had to do that or you'd starve to death in the street. So it was much different than what we would think of as a criminal.
Right. And this is so long before World of Warcraft, where the Thieves Guild was a sort of a, you know, nicely organized. Oh, sorry.
Work, work. Okie dokie. Ready to work.
Wrong podcast. Now, the last convicts, Letham, when did they arrive? When did the transportation finally stop?
Yeah, so the last convicts arrived in 1868, and they actually arrived in Western Australia, which is where I'm from. So they stopped sending them over to some of the other colonies around the country, but Western Australia was stayed in till you know very late. So 1868, and you know the transportation of convicts ended not because of an outcry in Britain, but more from an outcry in Australia. I mean, by this point, you know, infrastructure had already been established in Australia and gold had been discovered. So in its own right, Australia started to become a popular destination for immigration and, you know, in its own right. So we've got people who are paying their own way to get to Australia and are establishing their own lives and businesses. And, they're upright, upstanding citizens who have made a big commitment and a big investment to come to this new country.
They risked it all to
go
there.
Yeah.
Like your grandparents, in fact, or great-great-grandparents, I guess, right? I mean, they paid their way for them and their families to go all the way there in 1852.
Exactly. And it's these people, establishing in Australia who are getting upset about the fact that, you know, we're still the recipients of Britain's criminal outcast population there.
Right.
So, you know, it's just not fair that we should still be receiving your flotsam and jettison. And gold had been discovered. So there are a lot of people trying to, keen to get down there by this point.
Now, I was just going to say, at this point also, there was the evolving thought that transportation really wasn't seen as much of a deterrent.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the quality of life that some of these convicted criminals, even for those who were exported to Australia, were considered to be better in Australia than the criminals who are in Britain still, you know, particularly those who were still stuck on the infamous prison hulks, the old warships that were moored off the coast of Britain, you know, being used as floating prisons.
Right.
Yeah, and so for those people in particular, the concept or the potential of being sent over to Australia just would have been vastly more appealing than being stuck in a, you know, enclosed prison hulk. And particularly when you consider that some of these prisoners being sent over to Australia could actually earn their freedom after a specified period of time in Australia. So there were some instances, particularly of British prisoners in prison hulks who were already incarcerated, intentionally committing additional crimes to be transported over to Australia.
And they might even get land. Isn't that true? It might have sounded like a good deal.
Absolutely. I mean, I'd much rather, you know, have that, right, you know, wasting my days in a prison hulk, you know, be sent over to a country where you end up with sun shining down on you, for better or for worse, and a plot of land at the end of it, potentially. So not so bad.
Mm. So Letham, Australia declared itself as its own nation, free of England, in 1901. If these transportations stopped in 1868, what happens in these intervening 30-odd years to get to this point of independence?
Yeah, that's a really good question there. And I think it really came down to the prosperity of the nation. From a standpoint of natural resources, gold had been discovered there. So there was a huge amount of growth, population-wise and industry-wise, from the gold industry. And also, it turned out that even though Australia is very dry and arid, as far as the production of sheep, beef, and wheat and other grains, it was really productive. So there was a lot of prosperity there relating from the natural resources.
Gotcha.
So I think that really helped enable a colony, an outcast colony, become strong enough to be a nation in its own right.
And I wonder if there was any, you know, England would have to say, you know, if they wanted to say, no, we're not going to let you guys go. They would have to mount a naval offensive that would take them to the bottom of the world, right? I mean, was that part of it at all? Or is England just like, oh, okay, yeah, you guys just go do your thing?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think the fact that, the British Empire at that point was still expanding, and I think the fact that it would be seen as a friendly source of resources, a friendly source of military assistance if it was needed in that area of the world. I mean, right. You're absolutely right. So on the other side of the world, but still having ready access, because we still had agreements with Britain, we're, you know, still part of the Commonwealth, to be able to provide troops and resources if needed from that part of the world. Yeah, that was, I think that was a big consideration.
And they were needed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to get to that in another podcast if Letham will be nice enough to join us again, talk about World War II.
I'd love to.
We never do that.
No, yeah.
One of my favorite topics, absolutely.
What is the legacy today of these First Fleet convicts and the people that were sent there and shipped down? Because that has to have changed too over time.
Yeah, and I mean, from a legacy standpoint, both architecturally and culturally. I mean, so as I mentioned, we still see a lot of these very old, very established, very solid buildings around. So it's still very much a part of our life.
For example, the prison you mentioned is still being used.
Absolutely,
or was still being used.
Yeah, I mean that was you know built by convicts for convicts, back in the day, back in the late 18th century, but it was still being used up to the 1980s. It was then converted into a museum where you could actually go through and do tours of this astounding prison, and geez, you really get to see what it was like back then, just the brutality of the prison system. It was tiny windows, it looked like something out of Game of Thrones. I mean, Ned Stark would have been very familiar with all this. And it also has from the cultural side of it as well. I mean, it's very interesting. You read some of the international cultural guides about how people from other countries should handle working or talking to Australians. And they make reference to the fact that, you should avoid making reference to the convict history of Australian citizens as it could be considered embarrassing,
right.
which is absolutely wrong. I mean, Australians are very typically proud of this history because it really does reflect a prosperity from adversity cultural mindset. And Australians will always favour the underdog. So it's...
Or the down underdog.
The down underdog, exactly. So, thank you. So, we really are proud of our heritage. So it's certainly something that we're very keen to refer to. And being able to trace your ancestors back to the convicts of the First Fleet and the other fleets are really considered to be a point of pride. And, multiple prime ministers have been of Australia have been very proud of their convict ancestors, including Kevin Rudd and John Howard. John Howard actually has convicts on both sides of his family. Yeah.
And Kevin Rudd, I read that when they went down and presented that they'd found his... I don't know, fourth great grandmother or great great grandmother. And she was just a little girl at the time, 12. And I think that her and another girl lured a child into the bathroom and they stole her clothes. It's like, I mean, that's something you could see doing as a kid.
Yeah.
And it's like, thank God that it just really is amazing the things you'd get sent there at 11 years old or something. I mean, it's just insane.
You're absolutely right. And the bizarre nature of that story, to make it even more bizarre, is the fact that she was actually originally sentenced to death for that crime.
That's right.
And it was only through a reprieve from, a royal reprieve, not specifically for her, but for a number of people at the time. So it wasn't as if her case was so heartbreaking that they decided to give her a reprieve. It's just that they happened to have a bit of a moratorium for a large number of prisoners at the time. So yeah, so instead of her sentence was commuted from death to change to transportation.
And I would imagine that she'd never been at sea before, and it just brings me back again to how they would have felt. And most of them who'd never been at sea before, they'd be seasick, and they're the whole way and soaking wet on the deck. I mean, I wonder how many people just had to throw themselves overboard. I don't think I could last 8 days, much less 8.5 months. That's hardy stock.
Yeah,
that is hardy stock. And that's part of that pride that, I mean, this is what you're talking, I think what you're talking about, Latham. It's like, you guys are not, you come from tough, tough stock, and Aussies are kind of viewed that way, I think, now and internationally. It's I've always loved them for this sort of rough and tumble thing that they still seem to carry with them.
Oh, thanks very much. That's very kind of you to say.
I'm just afraid you're going to shank me.
we'll have to wait till next time we're at McSorley's. No. We'll sort it out then.
I think Letha may have the distinction of being the only Australian who's ever gone behind the bar at McSorley's and pulled a tap for some ass.
Oh, that was actually, I would love it if that was me, but it was actually my father. I got to say, I got a photo.
You come from the man.
Yeah, I was honored. He's the only guy other than the McSorley's all this stuff I've ever seen allowed behind the bar there. I was very touched. And my dad in Australia still sees that as one of his crowning glories, his time in McSorley's Ale House in Manhattan, one of his favorite places in the world.
That is great. And I do want to say, I don't want to, to any of our international listeners, we're not making light of Australians and of their convict background. It really is. It's a people I've always loved since I first visited there, and that was my first international trip. And I remain impressed and extremely fond of them, 33 years later.
Thank you very much. And I think, America being a colony of Britain as well, we've certainly got a lot in common. And I really think Australia and America have become so much closer over, particularly over the 20th century. The Second World War, mm-hmm. the American influence in the Pacific theater really from being invaded by the Japanese. So, we really have to thank you guys for preventing us from being invaded, and also for making the British send their the convicts over to Australia instead of America. So thank you so much.
No, I thank our forebearers. I'm proud of them for all they did.
Yeah, throwing off the yoke of the British and then having your back. And Australia to this day always is there for America, even when we're not really sure where we're going or what we're doing. The Australians are like, oh, hey, we can tag along. In fact, John Howard was actually at the White House on 9/11.
Yeah,
that's right. That's
that
right.
Was another kind of closer moment. In fact, the Canadians weren't too happy that President Bush failed to mention them that day, and because they were not really pleased. But, you know, John Howard is right there, and, you know, he did look a lot like Cheney. That was real comforting, you know. He was probably worrying he was going to get grabbed by the, you know. No.
He looked like Dennis Mitchell's dad, actually, more so, a little grayer.
Now, Owen was talking about his first trip down there to Australia, and you have kind of a little history flashback moment for us in your home, Brooklyn. So why don't you tell us about it? Take us to the Brooklyn Bridge.
This is the famous Brooklyn Bridge, 133 feet high, 1,500 feet long, contains hundreds of miles of cable.
So today is May 30th, 2013, the day we're recording this. On this day in 1883, only 6 days after its triumphant opening day, 12 people die, 3 dozen are injured on the Brooklyn Bridge in a panic-driven stampede. Now, historian David McCullough, who's author of the definitive work on the span called The Great Bridge, he has the tragedy taking place on May 31st, but the newspaper accounts of the day mark it as the 30th. Either way, nearly 20,000 people are on the bridge that afternoon, about 3 in the afternoon, when a human traffic jam forms on the New York side. Now, Brooklyn was still its own city then, thus the distinction. It was the city of Brooklyn on one side, the city of New York on the other. A crush of people formed as a group going up a staircase were met by a crowd going in the opposite direction. The one woman lost her footing, fell down the stairs. Another woman began to scream at the top of her lungs, causing a surge of people to see what was going on. Now, McCullough writes, people were so tightly packed that blood oozed from their noses and from their ears. 12 deaths, multiple injuries, men, women, and children on what was supposed to be just this glorious, an awesome Memorial Day with this great and amazing magical bridge. Possible causes range from people thinking that the bridge was collapsing. People blamed the media for that, go figure. Other causes were gangs of, quote, roughs were pushing and shoving people, inciting them to stampede. Either way, calamity on the Brooklyn Bridge 120 years ago.
And I think we were talking with Lethem about it, and I'm sure that the Brooklyn Bridge was a point that he wanted to visit. I remember when he got to this country with just his backpack and a smile and a bottle of Vegemite under his arm. It just reminds us of how hard and brutish life was back then. I mean, I had my air conditioning go out today, and my wife ordered a capacitor. I told her the capacitor was bad, and she said, well, what's that mean? And I said, well, it means we can't travel back to the future with Marty McFly. But yeah, so that was our hardest thing today. And these lives, the things people went through in Australia, the things that our ancestors went through, even 100 years ago, 120 years ago, those people lived such hard lives, and I think that's the thing we really love looking about at history. We can look at the First Fleet and say, I could never do that. I would be one of the people that was just dead. I would rather have the death sentence, I think. I don't know what facing it would be like, which is kind of the point. We also wanted to salute them with a song that you're hearing now in the background come up. Now, you know this song, right, Lethem? You've heard it before?
Oh, once or twice.
Traveling in a fighter combi on a hippie trailhead full of zombies.
Absolutely love it.
And I think it represents kind of the triumph of the descendants of the First Fleet, that now they could sing something happy. And I know that it's partially claimed to be a protest song, but it brings us some happiness, and a lot of people danced to it, even Lethem with his mullet back in the day.
Absolutely.
So thanks a lot for joining us, Lethem Burns. We hope that you'll come back again and discuss a lot of the other great Australian history things with us.
Yeah,
absolutely. Dean, Owen, thank you so much for having me, and thanks again for putting out such a fantastic show. I listen to it all the time, and it's a big part of my listening life. So thank you so much.
Not at all. It was great having you here, Lethem. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
I'm Lethem Burns.
Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Angry History Podcast. Good day. Did I do that good, Lethem?
Mate, you were fantastic.
I think the apostrophe is silent.
I said to speak my language. He just smiled and gave me a Vegemite sandwich.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.
That's right. I never wear pants.
Yeah.